Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. I'm Ruth McKee, and joining me today is author and teacher Kevin Curran. Kevin is from Balbriggan and has been a secondary school teacher there for over a decade. His fiction largely concentrates on working class life in the Dublin suburbs, and his first novel, Beatsploitation, was published in 2013, with his second, Citizens, coming in 2016. His new novel, Youth, is out now with Lilliput Press. And I'm very happy to have Kevin with me now. Just wanted to start at the beginning of your reading life, really, and take you back to when you were a little boy. And did you have books in the house, or what kind of reader were you? And also, if there are any books that you remember from that time that are important to you?
Yeah, as a kid, the house wasn't full of books at all, no. And my mum and dad killed me for saying that. There's a lie my dad said to me in my 20s before I moved out. He says, "If you bring another book into this house, I'll kill you." But he was joking, of course. But it wasn't a very bookish house, whereas my grandparents, my father, my mother's father, was very bookish. But in our house, there wasn't really books. And that's not to say I wasn't given books and I didn't have books. When I was younger, like, the ones that stick out for me would have been on birthdays you get books, and the ones that stick out for me always are, there's an abridged kind of Oliver Twist from Dickens, and an abridged Sherlock Holmes, and then I would have always been getting kind of comics and Tintin and Asterix and Obelix and Garfield for some reason when I was like 8 or 9 or 10. I loved the Garfield comics. But it's funny that when you think about the books that stick with you for when you're younger, the likes of Oliver Twist and the likes of Robin Hood and the likes of Sherlock Holmes, you kind of realise they've kind of stuck with you since then. That kind of, the setting, number one, and then just the kind of the stories as well. Like, I have to always pull back when I'm writing from kind of adventure stories. I know I did that with my second book, but... it's funny that they do, the kind of echoes of your formative years always stay with you when you're writing later on. I don't know how it works or why it works, but that's how it goes. Yeah.
I was thinking with Oliver Twist there, and I just remembered being forced to watch, I think it was the BBC adaptation of it. I don't know how many times we saw that at school. I think I could probably still visualise the kind of characters, and it was terrible melodrama in that kind of version of it. I just remember, and I absolutely loathed it because of that. I couldn't stand it. But then it made me think, so if you're teaching a book, you're going to be spending an awful lot of time with the text, you know, just like we were as well. You know, it was Oliver Twist for, like, it felt like eternity, but it was probably, you know, 3 or 4 months or something like that. So as a teacher now, you probably spend a lot of time in a book. But is that something you would naturally do anyway? Would you go back to books? Would you revisit text? Do you reread? You know, is there a book that you would go back to, or books that you would go back to?
Yeah, I've got kind of good at this now, in that I always remember about 8-10 years ago, I remember Rob Doyle saying in an interview about being a writer that he needed time to be a writer, he needed time to read. And I remember thinking, like, okay, well, so that's the package that comes. Now, obviously, I was a big reader, still am a big reader, but to hear someone say it, to say that, like, I can't work because I need time to be reading, I need to have a few hours to read, kind of made me think. So then I approached the teaching a bit differently then, and obviously I'm teaching 9 to 5, 9 to 6, so I'm a year ahead as well, so I decided to try and make use of what I was doing in the class with teaching, with the books I was reading, for my own writing kind of purposes. I didn't want them to be wasted. Now, they were never wasted hours, because you always enjoy the reading. But especially for Leaving Cert, you can pick books, and the Leaving Cert changes so often. So I'd pick books, and I would not experiment, but I'd see how the classes react. And even with the junior cycle books, in the reading of them, and see where the beats would be, and where the lull would be in a class, and where the kids would kind of get excited for certain pieces. And the same goes for the Leaving Cert books. And, like, so... certain books you have to reread. Now, of course, we're changing them as we go along, but to be in the school setting, there was S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders, which we're kind of still using, and we've been using for 6-7 years. So now I haven't taught the really junior groups in about the past 2 years, but before that I would have read that twice a year for 5 years.
Wow.
Which some people look at you and go, wow, that's, like, you know, that's intense, but I love it. You know, yeah. If it's a decent book, because imagine what you can do then when you're, well, and I always, we read it out loud, and I'd read bits, but I'd get the kids to be the characters, and I get, so then you get to see where the excitement builds, and you get to see where they do kind of tune out, and you get to see then how books work in a different way. You know, it's mad to see. And then of Mice and Men is another one. I've talked about that of late to other people. We used to do of Mice and Men, and again, I'd read it for the last 6, 7, 8 years. You come back to it every time, and you know where the pieces are, and then the same kids every year kind of enjoy the same piece. But then this year I got talking to a fifth year group. It was on the back, actually, would you believe, of we were doing a play, and something innocuous came up. It was nothing, but then I kind of stopped and said, one of the kids said about language being used in the play, and it was The Crucible. I was page 12, and it was literally nothing. You know, we all agreed it was nothing offensive, but the student themselves kind of felt as if it was. I think Abby described herself as putting on, I'm not going to go to Barbados and put on blackface. And the student didn't want to say that. And I was going to just, oh, look, that's nonsense. You can't. But then I said, okay, well, why don't you want to say that? Because you have to interrogate these things. Then we got into the books that we were reading in third year. And one student said to me, well, in Of Mice and Men, sir, there are words that I find offensive. Now, there's obviously a word you'd never use in class, but there's another word that would be, you know, the old term in the 50s for African American or for black. And then I was about to say, oh, well, James Baldwin and Emma DeBerry. And I said, no, if the student feels that way about a word being used, and it wasn't a word that we'd all think has been used in the class, who am I to try and change their mind? So my opinion on Of Mice and Men is kind of has veered for right or wrong. So, you know, after 8 years of doing it, I think it's not worth the hassle anymore. So we'll move off that. Mm. But in saying that, you get to see books like that in action. And then, of course, certain books, Great Gatsby, I did for a few years in the Leaving Cert, which was an absolute pleasure and joy. And then Foster, Claire Keegan's Foster. That was an incredible book to do with a group of Leaving Cert honours students. Like I'm very much about just no notes, just read the text. It's all about the text. And so we'd read it for pleasure, and then we'd read it, and then we would have read it about 3-4 times in 2 years with that group, because it's only a slight book. And Claire Keegan, I always was a massive fan of Claire Keegan before. I'm sure I'll tell you how in a minute, but just Foster, reading it at that intensity, at that level, is just, it blew my mind every time. It's an incredible, incredible, incredible book. But then to see the film, then everyone, then obviously the reaction to the film was, oh, this is so beautiful. But yeah, just the book is special. And I think, you know, the students realised how special it was. What a book, yeah. So I like to reread, as you can see.
Yeah, just hearing that, how your writing life and your teaching life are just almost inextricable. I mean, there's that sort of, like, you've got the osmosis with the text that you're kind of, like you're talking about Foster there, but that you're just kind of swimming around in all the time. But then you're getting all this kind of new eyes on it and new blood in it at the same time.
Yeah.
But it all seems almost kind of like, probably hard to say, but would you, if someone were to ask you who you are, what you do, would you say I'm a teacher, or would you say I'm a writer, or which would you say first?
Yeah. 5 years ago, I would have like, oh, I'm a writer. But then I've what's the word? Made my peace with it. I'm a teacher, you know, and I love teaching. I'm a year ahead as well, so I'm in charge of 150 kids, which is an experience in itself. But I'm a teacher, and I love the teaching. And then when I come back out here after school into the evening, I'm a writer. But I'm always, but you know yourself, you're always a writer, no matter what. You're always looking at things from a writer's perspective, and you're always, you know, that's in the classroom when you're doing texts. You're always looking at them from that perspective. Like even rereading again, just, talking about, like, I do a TY class, and I can make the course myself. So I do Tom Morris's, who has a new book coming out in August, but I do his story 17, which I'm not sure if you know it. It's just an incredible story. But I've read that every year for the past 8 years, 7 years in a class as well, just to see the beats, how different groups, 16, 7-year-olds take to it. I do Claire Keegan's Queer Name for a Boy every year, Hemingway's Hills Like Wood Elephants every year, just to see. And I know people would say, this is crazy, you're not so bored, but yeah, of course you change it up when you want to, but it's just good literature. I find if you just, every time you read it, something new will pop out and you'll see something. And especially for a teacher, I'm being educated as well as the kids at the same time. So
It's the old chopping wood, carrying water, and you're, you know, every year that's just your practice, is just getting into that deeper groove. Do you wish sometimes, I know that that Youth isn't your first novel. But with all that accumulative experience and experience isn't the word, but do you ever feel that maybe if you'd waited until writing your first, do you wish you'd waited until?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's one that you kind of go, oh, damn it. Yeah, but the problem is, if I'd waited till now, I don't know if I would have been able to write Youth. I remember when I wrote Beat Exploitation 10 years ago, I was people were saying, oh, wow, for a debut, the voice is so strong on page one. Yeah, but that was because I'd written an 80,000 word book 2 years previously that was leading up to Beat Exploitation. And then Citizens obviously came. But I think the other two books, I couldn't have written Youth without the experience of the other two books. And I think Beat Exploitation itself was a lead into Youth. I couldn't have written Youth 10 years ago. But I get what you're saying 100%. But then obviously as a writer, you think, would I have got in the door? Like for Youth, I had a lot of people, a lot of publishers were very happy to read it. I don't have an agent. So a lot of publishers were very happy to read it because of the stories I published in The Sting and Fly and the previous books. So I don't know whether, and even Lilliput had said no to Youth once, I think, and so they were happy to read it a second time after I did changes, and then of course the experience in that, like the book last year when I was doing the edits this time last summer, Youth wasn't the book it became because I was open to the edits, I was open to suggestions from Sean Farrelly, who's the editor at Lilliput. And would I have done that 10 years ago is another question. Yeah. You know,
it's like relationships really, isn't it? Like you kind of think you're not, yeah, the relationship that you're in now, you would never have happened had you not had the breakups,
exactly,
and the, yeah, learned about yourself and become the person, yeah, you are now as a writer. It's probably quite
exactly
similar.
Yeah, and I had an agent tell me 10 years ago they would have taken, they were happy to take on Beat Exploitation, and it probably would have become, you know, got a bigger publisher if I'd made a change at the end, and I being young, and I don't know, I don't think it was foolish, but just being young, I said, no, I'm not making a change. So I had no agent and I did what I did. And I always wonder now, 10 years later, would I make that change now if the same agent came to me? And I still like to believe I wouldn't, because the story didn't warrant that change. But there you go. You live and learn.
You live and learn. Yeah. And when, like, did you always have the grow for writing and for teaching, or what brought you to being a teacher now? When did you, how did you get into that profession, or what's that story?
I'm laughing because I think when I was younger, I always had a love for writing, but I was impatient, so I never finished anything. But like I was always writing, I was making books when I was 7 and 10 and 15. Like I was, you know, little books. I remember the stories even, and I used to make a lot of comics. And even I remember Roddy Doyle around when I was 12 reading The Commitments. And I think The Van, more so, I had a story about a five-a-side team done in the same Roddy Doyle style that I never finished. But I loved reading. And then I did a degree and a master's, because the master's was 1 year, the degree was three. So I just did it for the sake of doing it. And I was 21 when I finished it. And it was a master's in literature. And it was amazing. It's the most amazing year ever. But then I just worked. And it was my dad who said to me, why don't you teach? And this was like in my mid-20s, late-20s. I said, yeah, it's not a bad idea. But I was writing then, like even during the Masters, I remember writing what was it called, Green. It was a novella, which would have been about, I'd say, 30,000-40,000 words. So I was always writing. But then I went into the teaching. And you have to, some people aren't made for teaching, but I love it now. I genuinely love it. But, go on.
I was going to say, because, well, first of all, I would have loved to have had you as a teacher, and I think your students are very lucky. But the second thing I was going to say, for some people, it has the opposite effect. It kind of stultifies reading in a sense. For you, it seems to have been entirely the opposite. It's just blossomed. But I've lost what I was going to say to you. Now. Oh, yeah, it was about the freedom in the curriculum. You mentioned earlier, you know, you're teaching Leaving Cert. I have a daughter who's just gone through that. How much freedom do you have with the book choices? I know there are some set texts, but, you know, in what you can present to them, what you can open them up to, because it seems you have some incredible choices.
You do, but you have to take them. It sounds ridiculous, but I know a lot of teachers, not necessarily in our school, but in, you know, other schools which are what's the word, not more academic, but other teachers who are kind of more set in their way, and they want to make sure they get to H1, that they pick the same text every year, because Shakespeare is on every year, if you know what I mean. And Shakespeare can be a text, single text, whereas I don't do that. I every year I look for new texts that will obviously keep me in some way excited. So you do have your choice every year, like every year. Like last year I did Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun with my kids, and that class was like a real influence on youth. That class in particular, the Leaving Cert class I would have been with for the last 2 years, they were 50% Black Irish, and so it was important for me to find a text. And I've always been looking for texts that would in some way kind of try and get their experience, and that was Lorraine Hansberry's Raised in the Sun, and that was a joy. We watched two versions of that. There was a PDD version, which is atrocious, and then we watched the other 1960s black and white version, which is amazing. And then we would have read A Raisin in the Sun three times, you know, and just to see it play out in the class is a joy. But you do have a choice, like even Emma Donoghue's Room is another text I've done this year. And again, from both perspectives, for me to see how a book like that works in a room of 30 was amazing. You know, the lead up to the escape is long. And you feel that in a class when you're reading it with them. Now, they're enjoying every bit of it. But once they escape, you realise the lead up was long to give us the experience of being trapped. So then we can experience, you know, but you kind of, different points hit you different when you're reading out loud in a room of, you know, 28, 30 people. So I love it. I love how it intersects and how it then brings me back to the desk here and how I write. But I think the only thing I have to be wary of when I'm writing now is, I've seen it, and I've seen it in edits, especially with youth. Because you're in a classroom and you're explaining things a lot, I think that seeps into the writing a bit. And I definitely would see it in previous texts, not so much in the short stories I've written, but it's hard to kind of shut off. So you need a good editor, you need someone with an eye to say, you know, pare it back. You don't need to be so obvious in what you're saying. And that is, I am becoming aware of that now, that I do carry a bit of the teacher into the writing.
Oh, that's interesting. That, so you're too much exposition or too much that's really interesting.
Yeah, and the scenes have to be cut, like for writing, the scenes have to be much tighter. Less pull back in the description, pull back in the exposition, just go into the scene, keep the scene. And we did a text this year for Junior Certs, which is a really million selling text, and it's huge. I won't give the name because the writer's still alive, but I found myself doing edits on that because it was like a 400 or 500 page book, and I edited it down for the class because they just couldn't cope with it. So I would literally pull out, like with a pen, scribbling over about 3-4 pages at a time, and just literally pulling the text down to the dialogue, because they got as much from the dialogue as the 2 pages of exposition, you know.
Actually, that's something. I'm listening to youth. I'm halfway through listening to youth. I'm a big audio book person anyway, so I'm listening to you, Kevin, as I go out with the dog. Not to you, but to these amazing voices. And you know, there's something when I put on an audiobook, sometimes I know within 35 seconds whether I'm going to listen to it or not, and it's always down to the narrator or the narrators, you know. I quite often just go nope or yeah. And with this I was completely and utterly blown away, because there's so many, it's just fantastically voiced. I'm off on a tangent there because I want to talk about youth for a little bit. But there's, who did you get to narrate that? Because it feels, and you know, there's something else about, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking out of turn with this, but there's something so alive about it. Because at one point you hear a little rustle of paper, you hear a breath, or you hear, it just brings it really close to you. You know, you don't feel, it's not like, it's not even like you're it's like you're in a play or something, or that you're in a room with these voices.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience. See, I've been pushing the audiobook on everyone as well, because I can kind of pull back from the audiobook myself, and obviously the words are mine, but the performance and the emotion and everything is the actors, you know. So for starters, Kate Gilmore did the narrator, which is just, you know, it's 10 pages of an opening and 2 pages of an ending, and then she does a few bits in between. But then the four that Gabriel Adewusi did, Angel, Florence Adebambo did Princess, Colin Keating did Dean, and then Jordan Jones did Tanya. And I was kind of, I didn't think we'd get it together, because it was a big ask to get 5 actors and to kind of around the same time, because I had to be available to go into the studio with them as well to kind of oversee everything. But we got it together, and I remember they gave me Jordan Jones as the narrator. It said, what do you think of this? And I heard her voice. And I would have known Jordan Jones, not personally, but from TV. You know, she's in an Emma Kirwan thing that I use again in class, an Emma Kirwan poetry kind of film piece. And so I know her from that, and she was in Metal Heart on Amazon. So I heard her voice, and I said, that's Tanya. And the reason I'm going to Jordan first is because obviously I heard her in the studio, excuse me, and she was amazing, but I had to come back here to the shed and listen to all the edits to make sure there was no mistakes in it. And when you're headphones on, listening to Jordan doing certain parts of Tanya, oh, I was mind blown. Like, it was really, because she, you know, there's were real emotional peaks here and there with Tanya. Like, Tanya's very shouty at times, but she obviously has an intense relationship with her father, and she's kind of whispering into the mic at times, and it's like, wow, like you said, you feel as if you're literally, it's like a play. And then the other characters, just the way they bounce off each other, like obviously on the page, it works well. But to hear it in audio is a real joy and a privilege to see them all kind of working. And the way they all bring different things. We recorded Princess first, which is Florence. And her voice, as you know, if you listen to it, it's beautiful. It's like silk, and she grounds everything. And obviously Princess always was meant to be the art, kind of the one person who does ground everything, and to be the kind of artistic voice, and to be the person who can really express himself. But then to hear the voice of Florence and the way she plays it amongst all the craziness of Angel's slang and then Dean shouting it works really well, and it's lovely. Yeah. I just hope it, yeah.
And it's quite, I was going to say, is there a Spotify playlist to go with?
There is, yeah. Yeah, there is. I made one up for Peter, for the publicist I gave to him. I'm not sure what he's done with it, but there is one there. But the songs are all crazy. Like, even if you heard Tanya.
Yeah, it wouldn't be, so I was thinking it's showing my age, and I was going, oh, who's that now?
Even Tanya's first song that Tanya listens to, I was, Will I or Won't I, put it in. I said, I'll put it in because no one will know what it is. But I've heard about people Googling the songs, like, ooh, okay.
Yeah.
Because it's, yeah. Because it's WAP is the first song, Tanya, which is crazy, you know? And if you know what the song is, if people know, they're like, Jesus. I hope my ma hasn't, I don't think she Googled anything like that, you know?
Well, we'll come back to youth a wee bit later on, but it is, even in the rhythm of it, it is so musical. And I was thinking, what I meant to say to you there before I got carried off with something else was, it reminded me, not in style particularly, but you know Kevin Barry, when you open a Kevin Barry book and it's dialogue, and it's the dialogue that just brings the characters right into you straight away. You know, it's just, and you're there immediately, like, oh my God, I'm going to forget the title of it. What is his last one? A Night Boat to Tangier.
Tangier.
You know, yeah. And you know, when you open it up and you're kind of like two pages in, and you're just with these dudes. Very similar sort of.
Yeah. Talk about rereading. Wendy Erskine and Kevin Barry. I heard both of them read, I'm not sure where, but as soon as I heard them read, I went back to what I heard them read, and then got home just to see, because the way they performed it was wow. And then you go and read it, and you're like, okay, yeah, that's how it works. Like, I think it was from Beetlebone for Kevin Barry. He opened the Beetlebone, and he talks about someone walking like an animal through, and you just go, wow, you know, Kevin Barry's just, to have him, he read Youth and gave a little commentary, which for me is mind blown, because he's a superstar, you know, him, Claire Keane. Oh, yeah. So many superstars of Irish fiction, but
you just kind of go weak at the knees. But I remember hearing Kevin Barry at the John Hewitt summer school a few years back, and you know, I can't remember what he said, but I remember how he made me feel. But I really did. I mean, it was electrifying. I know it's a bit of a cliche to say, but he was electrifying. We were all sitting there, and everyone, you know, half the people listening were hungover and had already listened to, you know, God knows how many people talk about craft. And you could see everyone just, you know, and I went straight back to my room after that. And I was like, right, that's it. I'm going to complete. I need to relook at this and rethink what I'm doing, you know.
He also said, talk about craft. He also had a big part to play in Youth, because that same reading about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, it was for Beetlebone, so I'll tell you how long ago it was. He said a line that stuck with me and has always stuck with me. He said, he said it since, because I'd obviously listened to him a lot on YouTube, and anything that he has available online, I'd listen to. He maintains that certain towns and certain places have feelings, we have kind of vibes. And if you can tap into them, and then he always gives funny anecdotes about Limerick City and the techno a concert being on in the town centre. And I really kind of, so for Balbriggan for me, because we were just talking earlier, like I live in Skerries, I grew up in Balbriggan. There are different feelings. There's only 5 kilometres away from the difference. And when you walk through the town in Balbriggan, I really wanted to tap into that. And that, because of Kevin Barry, it made for youth the town and the town square and how it's falling apart and how it's been redone become a huge part of the book, all because I listened to him talk, you know. So he does that. That's Kevin Barry. He's amazing, yeah.
Yes, and is there, Kevin Barry, by the way, does not sponsor this podcast, just to be clear. But speaking of that kind of fire in your belly that you get, or that kind of moment of like, oh, I should look at that. Are there books along the way for you? I know we've talked a lot about teaching and how the text in front of me, but are there books outside of that you've read and thought, right, that's opened a door to me as a writer?
Yeah, it's funny because this podcast becomes the Kevin Curran teaching podcast. I won't talk about it quickly, but I did teach this book as well. And I've taught this book. They come on. Don Ryan, Spinning Heart. You can't get away from it. It just did the different voices, polyphonic voices. I was lucky enough to be able to teach that for maybe 3 years at different times for different classes. So I would have read it, obviously. I would have read that about 2-3 times before teaching it. And then I taught it. So that's twice a year for 3 years, so it's similar to 6 readings. So you know what I mean. So then you get, so that's a book that you kind of go, yeah, those voices, that opens up a world to you. But then As I Lay Dying as well, William Faulkner, for me as a reader, the text itself, we read it a few times, but it was more so two things. Daryl, the language of Daryl, I remember reading a William Faulkner interview where he says Daryl in the book was always meant to be the voice that he could express everything true, that he could really, because you know it's vernacular for most of the other characters, whereas Daryl was the centering. And then I just copied that with youth. You know, Princess was my Daryl. She was the person who I was allowed kind of stretch my legs, and a few metaphors, a few similes. She's all about colors and she's all about smells. And so that was where I was kind of getting a bit writerly and trying to you know, express and let everyone else be vernacular. But also, I'm not sure how I pronounce this name, I'll probably get it wrong, someone can tell me. Dewey Dell is a young 17-year-old girl in the text of As I Lay Dying. And at the end, I remember just reading it and going, wow, this, because it's obviously it's a multi-voiced story, and I saw the possibilities. So she's pregnant and she thinks she's pregnant, she is pregnant, and she goes to a chemist to get an abortion pill in the book, and she gets and she walks out and she's happy or whatever. But then we get another voice afterwards, that's the chemist, and we know that she's been ripped off. And I remember just reading it going, just being dumbfounded going, so this is what you can do with multi-voice kind of narration. You can cut the rug from underneath the reader's feet. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of other texts can do that. But that, again, see, this would have been, I would have read it 8 years ago, you know, long before youth. But these are the seeds that obviously seep then into your work and the possibilities. So that was a big text for me as I Lay Dying as well. And of course, Kez, like I have it here. I'm rereading it again. Kez for a Knave is just an incredible book. Yeah. That, you know, that stops you in your tracks. There's a scene where Billy Casper is in the school. I'm not sure if you remember it. Probably everyone will probably know the film. I'm sure everyone's read the book, and he doesn't want to talk in front of the class. And the teacher kind of pushes him along, says, come on, come on. And all of a sudden he lets fly. And it's the most gorgeous, beautiful, I think it's about 10 pages long, where if you were visualizing it, if you were seeing it on screen, which, you know, you can just tell he just finds his moment and he talks about the bird. Oh, it's the most incredible. That kind of takes your breath away, and it's the truest kind of thing. As again, it's a teaching podcast. You see it, yeah, you see it yourself in the room in front of you at many times, but to see it so done so brilliantly on the page is just, yeah, is amazing. Yeah, so that would be A Kester for a Name. What a book, yeah.
Well, we've talked a bit about, you know, what kind of writer you were maybe 10 years ago and how teaching has kind of informed things. Probably a kind of a seismic thing that happens to a lot of us is becoming a parent. And, you know, it changes who you are as a person. Well, as far as I know, it changes everybody. But it also probably changes you as a writer and a reader. First of all, were you able to read at all around the time that your child was born? You have a little boy, is that right?
Yeah, a boy and a girl. Yeah,
boy and a girl. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, first time when the tectonic plates kind of shifted, and your son was born, How did that change how you read or how you wrote? And is there a book from that time that you remember?
Leading up to Seb, Sebastian's my son, he was born in April 2013 and Beatsploitation was published in May 2013. So for me, it was just edits was leading up to his. And we were, you know, it was a crazy time in our life at that time. So just all edits. Like that book was 120,000 words. And just basically the publisher said, get rid of 30,000 words and we're good to go. So I remember that. And that was Sebastian. But again, I'm sorry. But again, I was doing The Road by Cormac McCarthy in school around the time Seb was born. And obviously I'd read it beforehand. But again, you get two readings of it when you're doing it with Leaving Certs. And The Road was a book that I associate with then. It's just, I nearly cried in class. Jesus, I didn't know. Thank God. You would never live it down. But just reading it with a class of seniors, and especially the end. And of course, you're emotional and you're raw yourself and you have a new son in the world. That was crazy. And I think I brought an LCA class, Leaving Cert Applied class. I think it was Finding Nemo around that time. But it's because we liked it for the kids like that. I always like to do the Disney way of writing. You don't really have the five steps or the seven steps of a story. So I wanted to bring them to a Disney story. And Finding Nemo fits perfectly the structure of a Disney story. So I brought them to that. I was nearly crying at the end of Finding Nemo as well. Because Sam was born. It's all about fathers and the rest. So The Road is a book, book.
It's one of mine as well. It's one of my all-time. I mean, and I have only read it once. And for some reason, it sits on the same line, and it's a completely different book to Solar Bones, and I don't know why. Maybe it's because I've remembered them both. I don't remember every book that I read. In fact, I forget nearly everything, but they've both sort of linked, and I don't know whether there's the same sort of... I don't know, mixture of absolute hopelessness and beauty and hope. Hope and hopelessness. It's just that wonderful cocktail.
Like for Solar Bones, that's another one. See, every book I read, I nearly has an effect on me. Like Solar Bones, I remember reading that. And I always kind of say it's like Ayrton Senna's, you know the documentary Senna. Have you ever seen Senna, the documentary? It's the most incredible documentary ever. But we all know Senna, it dies at the end. But still, it has this visceral impact on you when you watch documentary. And I felt the same with Solar Bones. And I was like, how has he done that? How? And that's it. If you were to ask me tomorrow about books that have had an impact on you, I remember sitting there and coming towards the end of Solar Bones, just my breath was taken away, going like, how has he done this? Like, we all know he's dead, but we're coming up to his death now at the end. And it's like, my God, this is just an incredible book. And the same with The Road. Like, obviously I'll be rereading it in the class, but I'll be rereading it. So like, how does he do this? And his language is the page is quite simple. Sometimes we'd have to annotate the dialogue because he pairs back so much, it's hard to follow dialogue sometimes for Cormac McCarthy. And the way he does it is just so pared back and biblical in a way.
Yeah, biblical is the right word.
How he describes the different work, all the different ways he uses, describes the blackness and the black and the clouds. It's just incredible. Yeah, what a book. And quite emotional at the time as well. Yeah, but great book.
It feels like I can't ask you this question after it because, you know, I can't imagine you having one, but a book that you would leave in there to burn.
Controversial, this one, yeah. Oh, every book is a joy. I do find a joy in every book. And it's funny you should say that. Since the kids were born, I've made a decision that everything I write, I want it to be in some way joyful. I do, because I just think there's enough negativity in the world. And I want my kids to read something of mine when they're older that brings them a bit of joy, you know. So I try and find joy in everything I do, you know, as far as writing goes. But unfortunately, again, this is back to the Kevin Curran teaching podcast. I did Frankenstein. I did Frankenstein with my kids in school maybe 2 years ago. And I would have read Frankenstein before. But again, it's just doing it in front of the class at 30. Wow, it was hard going. And I would never do it again. It was just hard going. Obviously, the themes and what it brought up was great in class, but the actual reading of it was hard. Like Robert Walton at the start, his letter to his sister, and then him reporting through the letter to his sister what Frankenstein was saying, and then Frankenstein reporting what the monster was saying to Robert Walton. for the sister's letter. It was just, and you're kind of like looking at the kids going, they're like, what? Are we meant to be taking this, like, you know, seriously? And I was like, yeah, well, within a way, it's kind of realist fiction. You know, it's sci-fi, but it's realist fiction. And then every minor character that was about to be killed, there's 2 pages of description to make you feel something for them. And then the kids would say, oh, this person's going to die now. Because Mary, she does it every time. The minor characters are never described until they die.
Just so about, yeah.
Yeah. And then just the character of Frankenstein himself, like, we're all looking, going, you know, I forget the name of the person that is sentenced to death because of the killing of the child and not the monster. And everyone's like, just why isn't, you know, Frankenstein say something? Oh, look, it was a book that I would happily just leave. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
I won't be doing that again.
I think it's always really funny because, you know, some people save the books that other people throw in. I think it was Nuala O'Connor that might have been one of her ones she'd pull out.
Oh no.
And it's one of your ones you leave in. No, but it happens all the time. And then Ulysses has been out and in so many times now. People are like saving it because it's it. And people are like, no, it's in the frame. So there's several like that actually. So it's a bit of a marmite.
I think I'm more, but I always wonder. I do always wonder what book would be the book that, you know, you'd be buried with or you'd have on your chest. Yeah, you know, when you're older. I used to always think it'd be Ulysses, but I don't know if I'm being truthful with that. I was like, oh, it sounds good, Ulysses. I don't know.
Maybe you just want to be found with it on your chest by archaeologists.
The book I've read the most and, you know, reread the most again, I did it with Leaving Cert, was Great Gatsby, you know, and it has just an effect on me. Even when I first read it, Claire Keegan introduced me to that book, not personally. She did a course in college that I attended one class and she said, you have to read this book. So I read it, and that's a book that's stayed with me ever since, and I always go back to it.
We're going to get on to youth now in a second, so before we do, I just have to ask you this other little question about what you'd save from your house that's not a book.
Two things I have to save. My dad is, he's a man's man. He's big, 6'2". You know, he does it all. He's not a builder, but, you know, he's do everything for people around the house and everything. But since he retired, he's taken up painting because he's always wanted it. He's always had an artistic streak. He played piano when he was younger, but because he got slagged, he stopped. Mm. He loves gardening because his mother, my grandmother, used to garden. So we started taking up painting, and we have a painting in the house it's off the sea, and it's amazing. I don't know how we did it. It's amazing. It's a wave breaking on the shore, and the moon is going down. And he gave it to me because I love art, obviously. And he had it up in the house, and I said, I'd love that. So he gave it to me. So I'd take that. And then my mother-in-law, God rest her, she passed away about 11 years ago. She was in the south of France, and she used to paint as well. And so we have a lot of her art up around the house. So we'd have to grab something to Marianne's. Yeah, so it's funny. There are two art pieces, you know, would be taken. Yeah,
that's lovely. Yeah. Right, I'm going to bring you back to youth again. Sorry, we kind of jumped in and out of it. But I'd love you to read something before I let you go. But before you read from youth, just we've touched on it a bit about what we just frame it for everybody. And maybe tell us a little bit about what informed it. And yeah, just tell us a little bit about youth. I know it's out now with Lilliput, isn't it? Yeah.
It is, yeah. And there is the audiobook.
Let's not forget the audiobook.
Youth is literally four teenagers walking the streets of Balbriggan who don't know each other, but they do slowly get brought together in subtle, unbeknownst ways. And we just see the four voices, or we hear the four voices telling us their own story. As the book progresses, and it is four voices, two boys, two girls. One is Tanya, 16, Dean is 17, Princess is 17, and Angel is 18. And it's just the streets of Balbriggan, and as they walk along the streets and as they live their lives, how they kind of get drawn to each other and the impact they have on each other. And that's youth, I suppose. Yeah, do you want me to read a piece?
I would love you to read a piece for us.
I'm going to actually read the opening of Princess, because it's probably the only opportunity I get. I always read Angel because he's the first page of the book, and I did that for the first page. I'm going to read Princess, if that's all right, just to open in 2 pages. So Princess is 17, and this is our introduction to Princess in youth. Princess, 17. The library on a Friday afternoon, like most afternoons and evenings, is her refuge. The soft silence wraps around her, as she moves through the electrical doors, clear of the town square's white noise. No phone notifying, no baby crying, no shower running, chores waiting, TV droning, speakers playing, toys chiming, dogs barking, neighbours shouting, doors slamming, footsteps pounding. Just a photocopier sweeping out two black and white counterfeits of a passport, while a lady smiles and whispers and the old man behind the counter silently nods along, stamping her books. Princess sighs and scans the tables. She smells of the cold. School jackets are an expense her mother wasn't willing to pay for in her final year. Her school jumper is unnecessarily big, lumpy, bottom of the drawer, lost and found effort last worn 4 years ago. Princess has knotted the back with a hair tie to tuck up and give her some shape. She's done the same with the skirt, folded up twice around the waist, hooked it there to provide some semblance of style. She walks into the library with a slow, heavy-footed scrape as if her feet are magnetised to the carpet. Her black runners pass as shoes in school, and sometimes, if her sister Becky is going somewhere important, she'll take a lend of them too, so they're loose from two pairs of feet confusing the material. It's not that Princess likes to walk slow. If ever a runner came off, she couldn't be sure her sock wasn't ripped at the heel or a big toe bright with green nail polish wouldn't be exposed. Crowded school corridors, don't ever forget. Or libraries. For some reason, the library is busier than normal. Princess is already growing weary of the struggle to find a small space for herself in this world. This place is becoming a microcosm of her home life. She flicks her purple braids over her shoulder with a subconscious sudden flap and, with what grace she can, sits across from a quiet-looking guy. When she whips her head, she feels her braids will establish pi r squared and provide a minimum space to exist in. Basketball taught her this in first year. No matter where she turned with the ball, some other girl was crowding her, slapping at her, hassling her. If she had braids, a swift turn of her head would clear the space. She removes her school bag quietly from her back and places it on the table. A faded Tippex Becky is scrawled across the front pocket. The corners of textbooks stick out through the frayed material on the bottom of the bag. The thin strands of material get lighter every day. She doubts there's enough thread to get her to June.
You've been listening to the fabulous Kevin Curran, reading from his new novel, Youth, which is out now with Lilliput Press. Join me next time on Burning Books when my guest will be author Tom Morris. See you all then.